Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 21st of January 2018. My name is T.R.P. Watson and this week I'm joined by Gareth James. We're now going to talk about Rita Sue and Bob Two at the Royal Court. This is a co-production between the Royal Court, Out of Joint, and the Ogden Theatre, Bolton. It's had a little bit of controversy attached to it. There were some allegations against Max Stafford Clarke about his conduct towards women, which led to him leaving Out of Joint, and it was decided by the management at the Royal Court that they would perhaps not bring this show in. After a large amount of complaints and, well, a couple of days later, they reversed the decision and some people had to rebook to the show. So it's come in under something of a cloud and also perhaps makes us look at the subject matter for this. The play was written by Andrea Dunbar and is moderately autobiographical, semi-autobiographical, first performed in 1982 when she was just 19, and it tells of the relationship between two 15-year-old schoolgirls and the married man they babysit for called Bob. So they are Rita and Sue, and Bob is the person with whom they have some rather, well, perfunctory sex. It is a rather graphic play in many ways. Other people in this play are Bob's wife, Michelle, who is relatively young, almost as young as her two babysitters. And we also have Sue's mum and dad as well. This production is directed by Kate Wasserberg, with set and costume design by Tim Shortall. It stars Taj Atwell as Rita, Gemma Dobson as Sue, James Atherton as Bob, Samantha Robinson as Michelle, Sally Banks as mum, and David Walker as dad. I can't remember if there was as much fuss about the play back all the way back in 1982. I mean, obviously it was pretty shocking back then, but now I think, especially when you can start using words like grooming, they're all speaking in Yorkshire accents. This is set in the same place that Andrea Dunbar grew up in, Bradford, the Buttershaw Council Estate. And obviously that takes on new meaning after all the ideas of grooming, and especially grooming of vulnerable young girls that happens here. So I think it has a slightly different meaning. And also there's the other thing of Max Stafford Clarke's behaviour in recent years, and actually going back quite a long way, that has coloured our perception of this. But I think overall, actually, this production captures some of the joy. It's a very... The sexual relationship is very ordinary. It's not, you don't feel that the girls are being tricked into anything or are being forced into anything that they don't want to do. But it's clear that they don't really understand the consequences of what they're doing. And I think that's what comes across here. Bob is never a particularly nice character, but he's not scheming. He's not evil. He wouldn't do anything really terrible, but you do really feel that he ought to get some kind of comeuppance for doing what he does. And that never really happens. People about him know what he's doing, but don't do anything about it. That certainly doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel right for 1982, but I suppose that that's in part the life that Andrea Dunbar lived, and so she depicts that extremely well. It is funny when it wants to be, and that is captured extremely well. I think this is a very good production. I think the three main characters especially are good, and especially the two young women here are very good. And this isn't just somebody... We often find people reviving shows just to say this is how things were. I think this has lots of relevant things to say for today and is still extremely relevant, and more, perhaps more relevant than it has been for a while. And it does show that we lost a very good and very interesting playwright in Andrea Dunbar. I mean, quite a lot of people have been talking about the fact that we don't have enough people who write from that working class point of view like Andrea Dunbar did, and we're not perhaps encouraging that kind of voice to come through. I mean, we have had a large number of young women playwrights come through, but they've all been, you know, rather smart and rather private school educated by the sound of some of them. Gareth, what did you think about this production?
Well, I think the controversy has overwhelmed and rather overshadowed the play, to be honest. I think we might have had a different attitude to it had that not happened. I didn't see the original production of the play, which she actually started writing when she was 15 in school, even though it wasn't produced until she was 18, 19. But in any event, having a the play produced at that age in the Royal Court is an extraordinary achievement. And it was adapted quite soon after that as a major film. I think it was 5 years later. But she only lived, as we said, she died young. She only lived until she was 29. And you know, in that short life, she did write 3 plays, and indeed she had 3 children as well, really. I didn't see the original production, but I did see a revival in 2000 when Out of Joint, and I think directed by Max Stafford Clarke, paired it with a play called State Affair, which was a verbatim piece, one of the first verbatim pieces, by Robin Soames, who researched on the same council estate, and it kind of showed the problems the council estate were having in 2000, which is much more about drugs than about sex. So Max Stafford Clarke has been involved in all 3 productions, the original as director of the Royal Court, the second one as director and director of Out of Joint, and the third because he, you know, at the time this was first mounted, he was still the director of Out of Joint. I think it's actually very much now a period piece, and I felt it was kind of like visiting a behavioural museum, you know, seeing people behaving in ways that they don't do now, and I likened it a bit to those TV series that were set in the 70s and 80s, Life on Mars and Ashes to Ashes, where you had to look at people's behaviour from a 21st century lens and kind of go ouch quite a lot, really. And I agree with you that the two girls are not doing anything against their will in reality. There's no sort of forced sex here, but they are underage and it's illegal, and they are being groomed by him. And indeed, after a while, they are both having full-blown affairs with him, unbeknown to one another. And in a way, the tables are turned because they become in control of how it unfolds from then on, in competition with one another, in a way. The attitudes you see from the other characters is quite interesting, because the attitude from Bob's wife can be probably best encapsulated in one of the, probably not the exact words, where she sort of says, well, if it's presented on a plate, you know, he wouldn't be a man if he didn't take it, which is an extraordinary attitude from a wife who's husband is having sex with underage girls. And then from Sue's mother, who just thinks it's all Rita's fault, she's being led astray by her friend. And I'm sure those were things that those people would have said at that time, but I actually found that really quite depressing. I think, you know, even though I say it's a period piece, of course, we do have contemporary cases of grooming on a pretty wholesale scale, and we do have the whole Weinstein and Me Too, and I suppose people's propensity to turn a blind eye, which they're also doing here, is telling us nothing's changed, really. It's just different, I suppose. I thought it was a very good production, although a little bit stilted at times, but the performances were outstanding. But when I looked at it, I started off feeling uncomfortable. I then kind of got intrigued about it, and over the next sort of 80 minutes or so, I kind of moved from indignant to fascinated to disbelieving to voyeuristic to whatever, really. I kept changing my stance on things. So I was glad I went to see it, but I felt my viewing of it had been affected by everything that's happening in society at the minute, and also affected by the controversy surrounding its play. But I wouldn't hesitate to say to people, well, go find out for yourself, because it is an important piece of work, you know, by a working-class playwright. We don't know much of that, do we? So a recommendation, but you know, but I would say to people, but you are, you know, you might find it difficult to watch, and the sex, certainly some of the sex is quite explicit.
I'm now going to talk about The Exorcist at the Phoenix Theatre. This is an adaptation of the 1973 film by William Friedkin, which was based on the 1971 novel by William Peter Blatty. It was written for the stage in 2012 by John Pielmeyer, and is directed here by Sean Mathias. This production was first seen at Birmingham Rep in 2016, and has transferred with most of its cast. It stars Jenny Seagrove as Chris McNeil, a successful film actor renting a slightly spooky house in Georgetown near Washington, D.C. Peter Bowles plays Father Merrin, the exorcist of the title, who we first meet in a scene where, after discovering a statue of Pazuzu in Iraq, he realizes that he is destined to meet with the presence that he has encountered before for one last time. Adam Garcia plays Farmer Damien Karras, a priest trained as a psychiatrist who is suffering from a crisis of conscience and faith after the death of his mother. Claire Louise Connolly plays Reagan McNeil, Chris McNeil's 12-year-old daughter, who falls mysteriously ill, and gradually it becomes clear that she is possessed. Tristan Rymark plays Burke Dennings, a friend of Chris and her director. And we also have Todd Boyce as Dr. Strong, Mitchell Mullen as Dr. Klein, Elliot Harper as Father Joe, Isla Lindsay as Sharon. There is also an uncredited voice recording by Ian McKellen, who plays the part of the demon or presence that possesses Regan. The set is, as I said, a spooky townhouse designed by Anna Fleischel. We also have lighting by Tim Mitchell, composition and sound by Adam Cork, and illusion and effects design by Ben Hart. I don't know William Peter Blatty's book, and I'm only slightly familiar with William Friedkin's classic film, but I understand this production sticks fairly closely to the plot and progression of both of them. In some ways, that probably creates difficulty for this production, as a number of the reviewers have pointed out how it fails to recreate the sense of horror that resonated in the film. Although they recreate a lot of the best-known and sometimes controversial scenes accurately, somehow they don't have the weight or the dread that the film had. Most people put the blame on Playmire's script, finding the dialogue clunky and some of the characterizations slight. I can see what they mean by with some of the characters, they felt underused and underdeveloped, but I can't say that I found the dialogue particularly awkward. For me, the biggest problem with this production was that the audience laughed a little bit too much and sometimes kept laughing when it was the last thing that the performers wanted. The laughter began as a nervous reaction to the blackouts and jump scares that the production employs, but slowly it seemed to morph into a desire to find humour in as much as they could. It was a pity because the actors are playing it straight, and in some of the key scenes of the play were really effective recreations of the movie, and some of the special effects used here were remarkably well done. Some of the reviewers have again put this problem down to Playmire being a little bit too melodramatic. I have to say, though, for all its faults, I found myself enjoying this play. Possibly not knowing the film well enough, I didn't regard it as a desecration of a cinematic masterpiece. Also, the play had a number of good performances. I always enjoy seeing Mitchell Mullen and Peter Bowles on stage, although neither of their roles particularly well developed, and this is a bit of a pity for Peter Bowles, who plays Father Merrin, the titular exorcist. But by far the most impressive performance came from Claire Louise Connolly, whose Regan went from a highly believable 12-year-old girl to a head-twisting possessed fiend. I think if you know and revere this film, you might find this play a little bit offensive, but I got the impression that most of the audience enjoyed themselves on the night I went. We're now going to talk about Five Guys Named Mo at the Marble Arch Theatre. This is a purpose-built theatre bang on Marble Arch in what is essentially a big traffic island or roundabout. I think it's it looks like a temporary structure when you drive round it, but it might be on for other things other than this particular production. Five Guys Named Mo is a musical with a book, Clark Peters, based on the music and lyrics and the songs, indeed, of Lewis Jordan. And it is also based on a sort of musical short done by Lewis Jordan in 1943. It was first produced in 1990 at the Theatre Royal Stratford East, and then ran for over 4 years in the West End. It was then revived at the Edinburgh Festival in 2010, starring Clark Peters himself, and has been back to Theatre Royal Stratford East. I remember seeing it back in 1990, because I am that old, and it had a very interesting cast, and I believe I did see both Clark Peters and, what was it, Mr. A? Yes, I think I saw Charles Organs in it, who was the choreographer for the original production. He may have been in it, or he may just have been the choreographer behind it, and indeed the director, I think, of the play, or the co-director of the play. Gareth, tell me more about this particular production, what you thought of it.
Well, I call it a homage or homage to Louis Jordan, who is a jazz legend. And I think that the play actually brought about a great revival in interest in Louis Jordan. I certainly didn't know about Louis Jordan before I saw this play originally, and I got really interested and started buying records, and he's become a kind of staple in my musical library, really. And what it does is it uses a story of a character called Nomax to link together Jordan's very characterful songs. You know, he's got songs that are called I Like 'em Fat Like That, and Messy Bessie, and Petting and Poking, Saturday Night Fresh Fry, What's the Use of Getting Sober, and Ain't Nobody Here But Us Chickens. So they're good, great titles, and they're great characterful songs. And the device he uses is we first see Nomax, and then the five Moes come out of the radio and other pieces of furniture to basically straighten him out, because his woman's gone and he's turned to drink. And as this was 1919, 27 years ago, I was kind of reflecting that this is a very early jukebox musical, probably predating Mamma Mia, I would think, which I think is the first I remember. So Clark Peters may well have invented a genre here when he did that. I think it is actually 9 years before Mamma Mia. But they are terrific songs, and they tell stories. They're often funny. They're an absolute joy to hear. And there's great choreography and movement to go with it. And in this production, they put a moving circular platform around the central stalls, and then a stage at the back where the band sits behind, with a platform that brings the band forward and back again when they want to. So the staging is, despite the size of this giant tent or big top or whatever, the staging makes it actually quite intimate, because I was sitting behind this revolving platform, but it was fine. And this is a new production by Clark Peters himself. And I think it just sits very well in this, I say tent, I have to say it's a luxury circular tent, but it sits very well within this kind of structure. It works particularly well when there is a scene in a New Orleans club, and then at this point in time the walls are used, as in the second half. And, well, it just sort of kind of came alive, particularly, I thought, in the second half because of that and because the band is brought forward. But overall, you know, it's very well paced, and it's a little bit too much audience participation for my liking, but that's just me, probably. But I think it's great to see it again, really. I saw the original production in Stratford. The sort of the myth, which I think is true, is that Cameron McIntosh turned up one night, and by the interval he thought, this is amazing, and he sort of went to see Philip Headley, who was the then artistic director at Stratford East, and said, I want to take in the West End, but I want to take in the West End like now, and did a very generous deal there and then, and it was in the West End in actually no time at all. I then went again when it was in the West End. It went on, after the 4 or 5 years it spent in London, it went on an international tour, and ended up, I think, in Broadway. And I happened to be in, I can't remember if it was Munich or Hamburg, when it was touring Germany, so I nothing to do in the evening, I went to see it again. And I did see the Edinburgh Fringe revival 7 years ago, which wasn't directed by Clark Peters, that was, I think, Paulette Randall. So I got a soft spot for the show, I have to say, because I do find it particularly joyful and uplifting, and it's a party show, and it really works very, very well in this setting. So I don't know how much longer it's going to run, but I think it's booking for a while yet, and I think it may well extend. It was a very healthy audience on a midweek January night, and I suspect the structure may well stay there and feature other things. It's a joint venture between Cameron McIntosh, the City of Westminster, and the Udderbelly organisation, who are famous for using sort of structures like Spiegel tents. So I suspect they haven't, you know, even though this is the only show booked there, I suspect they'll use it again. So it's good to have a venue like this. It's great to see Five Guys Named Mo back again after all this period of time. I wish you every success, really.
Yeah, I have to say, remembering back all those years ago, I was very unwilling to join in, but I did find myself joining in the audience participation towards the end. Although I was lucky, slightly lucky at least, that I wasn't forced to do a massive conga that they broke into and took out most of the people in the stalls, you know, made most of the people in the stalls get into that conga on the night I went. But yeah, certainly, I think I bought an album of Lewis Jordan music, so it's certainly something where if you don't know his music, you'll come out humming all the tunes, because it's incredibly entertaining and very much a worthwhile show. And it's good to see that Clark Peters, who perhaps might be better known to some people from The Wire, but it's great to see him, you know, coming in and reviving his show, because I think it's very well worth seeing.
And I think it's getting a new audience now. I kind of looked around the audience, you know, I thought, well, quite a lot of you wouldn't have come to this in 1990. And there was a nice, healthy group of young people who were kind of seeing this and connecting with Lewis Jordan for the first time. So that can't be nothing but a very good thing for me. And in addition to coming out humming, you also come out smiling, because it is actually one of those shows that's kind of very infectiously funny. And there aren't many of those.
I'm now going to talk about Heartbreak House at the Union Theatre. This is George Bernard Shaw's 1919 play, directed here by Phil Wilmot as part of his company's Essential Classics 2018 residency at the Union Theatre. The set design here is by Justin Williams and Johnny Rust, who have created something that resembles the deck and quarterdeck of a ship, with Captain Shotover at his desk on the quarterdeck, a place on a ship reserved only for the captain. The play is set in a ramshackle titular heartbreak house on the east coast of England. Young Ellie Dunn, played here by Leanne Harvey, has been invited to dinner by Helen Anker's character Hesione Hushabye. Hesione is trying to dissuade Ellie from marrying an old industrialist called Boss Mangan, played here by J.P. Turner. It turns out, though, that while Ellie wants to go through the marriage anyway, she has fallen in love with a stranger, played by Matt Betteridge, that she met in the National Gallery. This stranger happens to be Hector Hushabye, Hesione's husband, and hurricanes hardly ever happen. This doesn't trouble Hesione, as everybody seems to fall in love with her husband. When Ellie first turns up at the house, she finds herself abandoned until James Horn's Captain Shotover, Hesione's father, comes along to talk to her. Eventually they become friends, and indeed Ellie even considers becoming the captain's white wife. The captain thinks he still has a Jamaican wife somewhere. Other guests at Hesione's dinner party include the captain's estranged daughter, Lady Utterword, played by Francesca Burgoyne, and her doting but unloved husband, Randall, played by Toby Spearpoint. Also, Ellie's father, Manzini Dunn, played by Ben Porter, turns up. Other characters in the play are Nurse Guinness, played by Alison Mead, who looks after the captain and the house, and a burglar, played by Richard Hofst, who gets deliberately caught, and after telling a tale of woe, insists that he will turn himself in unless everybody pays for him not to. Apparently, this is quite an effective strategy, but it also turns out that he's an old shipmate of the captain, as well as being Nurse Guinness's husband, so this time it fails. As this is sure, there is a good deal of talk, especially about the differences between classes represented here, as well as the differences between the rich landed gentry and up-and-coming industrialists who have profited from the war. A lot of the reviews have concentrated on the connections between this play and the work of Chekhov. This is something that Shaw intended. Indeed, in the introduction to the published version of this play, he talks about the connections with the Cherry Orchard in particular. Had I not been told about this or read about this, I might not have seen the connections. As it is, I really didn't notice them at the time, although perhaps they are more obvious once you've seen it and found out about it. What I get from this play is Shaw's sense of the world is coming to an end. Certainly, at the end of this play, those characters who have survived the bombing and explosion of the captain's dynamite store are hoping that the bombers will return and finish everybody off. It is perhaps an illustration of Shaw's mood at the time. The rebellion in Ireland was gaining strength, and there was a tremendous fear engendered by wartime Zeppelin raids, which was only likely to get worse after the introduction of specialised bomber aircraft in all air forces towards the end of the war. This is a subject dealt with in later years by H.G. Wells in his work Things to Come, and the fear of the destructive power of bombers was something that grew and grew in the years leading up to the Second World War. Indeed, I have heard it said that some people took to the air raid shelters in 1940, believing that in the unlikely event they survived, there would be nothing left to survive for. This production worked pretty well. I find Phil Wilmot is a reliable pair of hands when it comes to directing plays, and classics especially. It was certainly well performed, and the Shavian talky bits were well handled and often very entertaining, but it did rather fade in the shadow of the Orange Tree's recent production of Misalliance, which had reviewers calling for revivals and re-evaluation of that play in particular, and Shaw in general. This production hasn't garnered anything like that amount of heat and excitement, but I think that's because this play is darker, talkier, and dare I say more Chekhovian than the Misalliance, and probably harder to get excited about. That said, this is a very decent production of the play, and well worth seeing.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are, AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.